So Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 to 6. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do. And we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses in Israel said to them, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. We're going to look then at this passage in the book of Ezra, chapter 4. Two apologies at the beginning, one slightly tongue-in-cheek, an apology to those of you that don't think it's been a good sermon unless it goes on for about 50 minutes, but as there aren't many of you, that's slightly tongue-in-cheek. The second one, which is a little bit more sincere, is my apologies to those of you that really don't like history, because it's vital that we have a little bit of a look at history at the beginning here, because otherwise the rest of the passage makes no sense and much of the book of Ezra makes no sense. But if you can hang in there with me, it's not going to be that long, but hopefully you'll see that it has a contemporary relevance as well. And it really comes from the first two verses and trying to sort out who are being referred to when they're called the people of the land. The people of the land. So here's your bit of history. Whenever the Assyrians conquered a nation, they had a kind of standard way of dealing with things. They would do a massive population relocation. And one of the things they did was to take the brightest and the best, take the nobles and the royal families and move them from wherever they were to a completely different part of the empire. And we have an example of that in the beginning of the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, we read, "Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding and learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace." And then we're given, in the end of verse 4, the reason: to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And we know from the book of Daniel that it was not just the literature and the language, it was the food, it was the entire culture and lifestyle. So a group of people were taken who left in their own land with their own population might well become the leaders of a rebellion, but moved somewhere different in the empire, not necessarily to the capital, but moved somewhere else. And a shifting around of artisans and skilled people, what you had was much less likelihood of a rebellion, because people of different languages, people from different cultures were now occupying a ground. The other reason they moved population around was that whenever they invaded, there were two choices that a nation in front of them had. They could either capitulate, in which case the land would largely be spared. cities wouldn't be destroyed. There wouldn't be a kind of wholesale burning and destruction of the kind of agricultural land, and things could settle down. But where, as in the case of Israel, the northern kingdom and later on Judah, the southern kingdom under the Babylonians, where they did resist, then city after city would be destroyed. If you go to the British Museum in London, when it's open, you can see what's known as the Relief of Lachish. And it's a massive, great carving, a 3D carving, which shows you the Assyrian attack on Lachish. And you can see how they destroyed the cities and so on. So these people of the land were these migrants that had been brought from somewhere else to populate the land of Israel, the land of Judah. And there they were. Now, we know that's what they were because Ezra 4:2 tells us that. They say, we've been sacrificing to him, that is God, ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. So that's who these people were. And we need to ask ourselves the question now, why did the returning exiles reject them? Because they do. When they come, and let me just reread that little bit for you. Let us build with you. Verse 2, for we worship your God as you do, and we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. And the response from Zerubbabel and the others is, you have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God. We alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. So their offer, which seemingly on the face of it is a very nice offer, we'll join in, more manpower, get the job done quicker. And the response from God's people is, no way, you're not going to be able to do that. The reason is that they are this migrant population. They were rejected. Just listen to the language of verse 2. These people say, let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do. And then we'll come back to the second bit in a moment. And we have been sacrificing to him. Now, there are two issues here. Firstly, they still seem almost as if they've embraced the true and living God, Yahweh, as another in their pantheon of gods. It's still your God, they say in verse 2, that we're worshipping. If you think of the book of Ruth, for instance, when Ruth refuses to abandon Naomi and decides to go with her, whatever, one of the things she says is, and your God is my God, my God. But these people of the land are still referring to God as your God. And the fact that their worship was a kind of mixed multitude, if I had a heading for this first section, I would call it a false ecumenism. A false ecumenism. If these people had really understood the worship of God, then they would have known that they shouldn't be sacrificing to God. Because the priestly office, the ability to sacrifice from the time of Moses onwards, had become the prerogative solely of the children of Levi, the sons of Levi, and in particular, for sacrifice, the sons of Aaron. So by sacrificing to God, which they put forward as an evidence of their true worship, they've actually proved the opposite. They've proved that they're not really understanding the gospel at all. They are a little bit like the Samaritans of the New Testament. You know, you Jews worship on Mount Zion, we worship here. What does it matter? two examples. Let me give you just briefly two very, very quick examples. As early as the days of Moses, Numbers chapter 16, there were a group of people who we know that there was a Biram and Korah and so on amongst them. There was a group of people who thought, well, why should the Levites be the only priests? Why should the sons of Aaron have a monopoly on this? We will act as priests as well. Self-appointed, not chosen by God, just as these people of the land had appointed themselves as priests and given themselves authority. Now, Moses sees this as being such a critical issue that he stakes his own life, as well as his reputation, on the fact that God will supernaturally back him up when he says, you are false prophets, you are false priests, and you are under the wrath of God. You're not serving him. Let me just read it to you with putting the emphasis where I can. Moses challenges them to bring their censers and put the incense in it, and there to offer worship with these censers full of incense. The Levites will do it, the sons of Aaron will do it, but also these followers of Korah and Abihu and so on, they're going to do it as well. And this is what Moses said. If these men, these false people, die, or if they're visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. Moses is putting his whole leadership of God's people on the line. If they die naturally, or some natural catastrophe that often happens, then you'll know that God is not with me. But he says in verse 30, if the Lord creates something new and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And as soon as he'd finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up. So you can see, this was not a minor issue as far as Moses was concerned. It was critical to who the people of God were. One more example very quickly. When the northern kingdom separated from the southern kingdom, you remember David and Solomon rule over the United Kingdom, and then Rehoboam, who's an idiot, loses it all. And from that moment on, there's two kingdoms, Judah in the south, ruled over by the house of David, and the northern kingdom, which has multiple different dynasties ruling over it. But when it first occurred, the northern kingdom had a problem because all of their citizens still wanted to go south to Jerusalem to worship at the temple, to offer sacrifices to their God. And it became fairly obvious that if this goes on, eventually they're going to want to be reunited with each other. They want to go back to their brothers in Judah. And so the only solution that these people, Jeroboam in particular, can come up with is, we'll create our own Jerusalem. In fact, we'll do one better. We'll create two. One in Dan, the very north, and one in Beersheba, towards the southern borders of the kingdom. And we read, this thing became a sin. This is 1 Kings chapter 12, 29 through to 33. This thing became a sin for the people who went as far as Dan to be before one. He also made temples on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day and the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. And he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he'd made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. And he went to the altar that he had made in Bethel. And so it goes on. he creates a duplicate, a replica of the true worship of the living God. And much later, the prophet Amos was to challenge God's people and say, come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal and multiply transgressions. Bring your sacrifices. But you notice he says, that's not worship, that's transgression. So that's who the people were. And it partly answers the question why they were rejected. So let's look at that in a bit more detail. Second point, the offer is rejected in verse 3. There were two reasons, and both of them are really important if we're going to understand. And then we'll come to some practical application. First of all, there was a political as well as a religious justification for the decision. And here we see something of the amazing wisdom of God. The decree of Cyrus was very specific. It's recorded for us back in Ezra chapter 1 and verses 2 to 3. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, to rebuild the house of the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. From Cyrus's point of view, it is only the Jews that are to participate in the rebuilding of the temple. There's a political reason for saying to these mixed multitude, the people of the land, no, you can't be part of this, because they didn't have the authority of Cyrus to be part of it. Now, in chapter 5, which is some considerable time later, after we'll see later on in chapter 4 that these enemies of God's people send a complaint about them. Listen to what happens in chapter 5. At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Sheshbozenai and their associates came to them and spoke to them thus. They're addressing the people who are rebuilding the temple. Who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure? And they also asked them this: what are the names of the men who are building this building? What are you doing? What's your authority? And who are you? We want a list of the names of everybody involved. Now, you can see, without jumping ahead to chapter 5, if that list is going to include a whole group of people that Cyrus didn't authorize, then there is a ground for saying that they are not obeying the command of Cyrus. So there's a political reason. But the main one is a spiritual reason. There's a vast difference between accepting individuals who are genuinely in a personal relationship with God and have embraced the pure worship, and those who, for whatever reason, simply want to be associated with or included in the circle of God's people. Genuine converts will include people like Ruth, who we've already mentioned, or Rahab, who embraces the kingdom of Israel. Those that are not that kind of people will include, for instance, Solomon's concubines, who come and seek to mix and mingle worship of the true God with worship of their own gods. And eventually Solomon concedes to this, and he allows false worship even within the bounds of Jerusalem. In Ezra chapter 6, you see we're jumping ahead to make the point, verses 19 to 21, on the 14th day of the first month, the returned exiles kept the Passover, for the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together. All of them were clean. So they slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the returned exiles and for their fellow priests and for themselves. It was eaten by the people of Israel who had returned from exile, and also by everyone who had joined them and separated himself from the uncleanness of the peoples of the land to worship the Lord, the God of Israel. Ezra's not a racist. Ezra isn't saying because you're not Jews, you can't be part of this. He's saying because you're not part of the community of faith, because you're actually disobedient, you've created your own priesthood and you're offering your own sacrifices, you don't belong with us. What is unacceptable to God is people who try to keep a foot in every camp. You remember the challenge in 1 Kings that Elijah lays down for the people. There they are, they're worshipping the true and living God, but they're also worshipping Baal. And Elijah comes near to the people when there's this great contest between him and the prophets of Baal. He says to them, how long will you go limping between two different opinions, or hopping about, some of the translations say, between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. They were unwilling to let go of this syncretism, this dual worship of true God, false God. Right worship, false worship. Now, let's try and apply this. And I think we can apply it in a number of different ways. One, in our relationship with the state. In allowing the people to return and rebuild the temple, Cyrus was working under the hand of God. He was moved by God. Cyrus himself says that. It's not suggesting that Cyrus is a believer, but he is an instrument in the hand of God. And he gives them a very specific legal authority to do what they're doing. And what we'll find both in the book of Ezra, and I'm sure you've already remembered it from studies in the book of Nehemiah, which is a more familiar book than this book of Ezra, there are occasions when their lives, their bacon's pulled out, you know, their bacon is saved, their lives are pulled out of the fat by the very fact that they can say, yes, we have legal authority to do what we're doing. And it's for that reason, I think, that there is an injunction upon us. Paul in Romans 13 and verse 1 says, let every person be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. So Paul's command to the Roman church is, obey the authorities. 1 Timothy 2:1, he says, but don't just passively obey them, pray for them. Paul says, first of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and for all who are in high positions. Why? Well, Paul has a reason, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. We get the government we pray for to a degree. And it is no good us complaining if the government passes legislation that we don't like, if we haven't been making the Christian voice heard, and we haven't been making the church's voice heard at the throne steps of God. If we are not praying for our government, if we are not beseeching that the Prime Minister, the government, Her Majesty's opposition, 650 MPs in Westminster, politicians coming into the Senate and the Scottish Parliament and the Northern Irish Assembly and county councils and town councils up and down the land, if we're not praying that God would use those people to bring us a peaceful and quiet and godly life, well, we deserve what we get. That's the first practical application, I think. These people kept the law. Now, I don't think I need to remind you that there is a limit to our obedience to the state. And that limit is made very clear, isn't it, by Peter and John in the early chapters of Acts, where they're commanded to preach no more in the name of Jesus. And they say, well, whether we be obey men or God, you judge. And in other words, we're not going to listen to you. And when the state, be it the government or any authority, tells us that we must do something that God tells us we must not do, or tells us we must not do something that God tells us we must do, then it comes a moment when we can say, no, we can't do that. But before that, we should be obedient, and before that, we should be prayerful. The second application under this point is the spiritual one. Sometimes believers can get confused. And if, like our own church, you hold to a non-ecumenical position, that doesn't mean that we're saying that there are no true believers in any group, any church group, any group that is not kind of able to sign up to our entire basis of faith. Of course there are. There is a difference between accepting the individual believer who has embraced the faith and accepting a religious grouping, a denomination, whatever we want to say, that fundamentally by its teaching and by its practice is not in harmony with the word of God. Such a group is like the people of the land. They are not doing what God has commanded them to do. Individuals are like Ruth and Rahab, and are welcomed not only into the church of God, but are welcomed in Ruth's case into the lineage of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. So two applications there. Thirdly, last point, dog in a manger. Dog in a manger. There's another word used in verse one, which I deliberately passed over because I think it's being read back into history. Verse 1 says, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, and they're later described as the people of the land, and that's what I picked up on, but it seems a little odd, doesn't it? These are adversaries, and yet they're saying, can we come and join you? We worship just like you do, and we've been sacrificing all the time we've been here. I think what's happening is that Ezra has simply read back into history something that would later become very, very apparent. These people were going to act like adversaries. That's why I've called it dog in a manger. Because these people of the land were not permitted to join in, they become very, very, very confrontational, and they oppose the work of God. Now, there's no problem, is there, with Ezra reading that back into history and saying, yeah, these were the adversaries of God's people. And he's then going on to say, well, this is how they became the adversaries. I was listening to an item on the news recently, and it maintained that the Queen had been married to Prince Philip for 72 years. Now, if you want to be nitpicky, and I suggest we shouldn't be, it's not actually accurate. When she married, Elizabeth was not the queen. She was Princess Elizabeth. And he was not Prince Philip. He was the Duke of Edinburgh. He didn't become Prince Philip until 1957. And she didn't become the queen until 1952. So if you were to say how long the queen had been married to Prince Philip, you'd have to start counting from 1957. And if anybody seriously argued that, you'd say, oh, for goodness sake, get a life. You know what I mean. And we know what Ezra means. These people become the adversaries of God's people. So how does it manifest itself? Three things very quickly. Firstly, discouragement. Discouragement. If you have a look at the word, if you get hold of a good concordance or something traced through the Strong's numbers or something like that, you'll find that discouragement is linked with helplessness, being feeble, being faint, being weak. Discouragement is corrosive. And just by way of application, can I get us to think about ourselves? Husbands, wives, are you encouragers, which is the opposite, isn't it? The opposite of a discourager is an encourager. Husbands, do we encourage our wives? We knew one family who the husband always made it clear to his wife that anything you can do, I can do better. And that applied to everything. He was hypercritical of anything that she did. The housework was never done to his standard. He was a better cook than she was. He was cleverer than she was. The disciplining of the children should be left to him. And the end result of that was that a perfectly able woman became just a barely functioning person. Wives can discourage their husbands from leading the family spiritually. What about our children? Do we discourage them? It was a joke between me and my children, and I'm pretty sure they knew it was a joke. At least I hope they did. I'm fairly confident they did. If they got 99 in an exam, I'd say, what happened to the other point then? But you would reinforce them. You'd say, that's a great bit of work. Well done. You've really tried hard. If we don't encourage our children, they're going to get nowhere, are they? And what about our church leaders? Do we encourage them or do we continuously discourage them? Are we always being critical and negative and empty? Romans 1:11 says, I long to see you, says Paul, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. Barnabas is known as an encourager, the son of exhortation. He's an encourager. I just want to challenge every one of us, myself, starting with me, but am I encouraging my wife? Do I still encourage my children? Do I encourage people in church? Do you encourage or are you a discourager? Some people are so precious simply because they are encouragers. They never say anything that isn't true. They're not flatterers, but they're encouragers. Second thing we learn about these people is that they bribe. Wow. Can you believe it? Here are people bribing politicians. Well, I never did. I wouldn't have believed that would happen, says he with the tongue sticking right out of the side of his cheek. We get weary of it, don't we? I'm not going to comment on anything that's presently in the news because it hasn't been investigated yet. But once again, it's accusations of sleaze. There were all the scandals around the kind of, you remember the what were they known as? They were known as the John Lewis list, where MPs, cabinet ministers and so on were discovered to have been basically feathering their own nests in a way that was just about within the bounds of legality. But it really wasn't there at all. It was well beyond this. And sometimes it can be dressed up, can't it? It's stealing and it mars people's testimony. But while we're thinking about politicians, what about ourselves? It's a temptation, isn't it? If you're a low-paid worker, an underpaid worker, an undervalued worker, to think, do you know what? I'm worth more than this. And so what does it matter if I massage the truth a little bit? What does it matter if I take stationery home from work? What does it matter if I make a load of private calls from work when I'm specifically not allowed to? What does it matter if I just kind of alter my tax expenses a little bit so that my income goes down a bit and my expenditure goes up a bit? We may call it all sorts of things, but God calls it theft. And these people were bribing officials in order to get their own way. And any official who's guilty of bribery is a scandal. But anyone who seeks to bribe an official, and sometimes, let me just say this, in some countries, it is very, very difficult. Christians take a stand against being bribed. But they also understand that sometimes the police officer or someone who wants a bribe to turn the other way from a minor traffic in infringement, instead of you paying the fine, let's say the £100 fine, it wouldn't be pounds, would they? But the £100 fine, you know, you give me 50 and I'll let you walk away. And sometimes the reality is that police officer may not have been paid for month after month after month. And he's got a family at home that are hungry. We may be able to understand the reason sometimes for this culture, but it's dangerous. And we as Christians need to make sure that we do not fall into that trap. Thirdly, lastly, they frustrated the purpose. And this, it seemed to work. Jesus warned against frustrating. Luke 11, he says, "Woe to you lawyers, for you've taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves and you hindered those who were entering." It's also the work of Satan, isn't it? He seeks to hinder, to frustrate the word of God. 1 Thessalonians 2:18, because we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, again and again, but Satan hindered us. Well, we don't want to be involved in hindering the work of God, do we? And being like Satan. And one more domestic example, 1 Peter 3:7. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honour to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life. But then, as so often Paul does, after his instruction, he gives his rationale, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So we're back to husbands again. I feel no compunction in emphasising this one as a husband. But husbands, if we can discourage our wives, we can also frustrate our wives. And if we do, we run the risk, Peter tells us, of hindering both their prayers and our prayers. And I trust this is part of your family life, your prayer life together. So these people who started off from the wrong basis, wanted to be involved without actually changing, wanted to kind of join the church without being converted, now become the enemies of the people of God. And as we work through the book of Ezra, we'll see how that works out. But I hope there's something to get our teeth into in that, and quite a bit for us to be able to do a bit of self-examination on.